You're listening to Wisdom of the Ages, the show that taps into the many expressions of universal, ancestral, and personal wisdom to ignite evolutionary consciousness.
Welcome and blessings. This is Anne Kate Sullivan, host of Wisdom of the Ages. I love interviewing creative authors, spiritual teachers, and leaders from around the world who have positive messages to share for the times we live in. I believe we're standing on the brink of a new paradigm of consciousness and a new type of spirituality. So you can listen to many more fascinating Wisdom of the Ages episodes on superpowerexperts.com/wisdomoftheages. So today we will be discussing a topic that people are often hesitant to speak about: life, death, and the afterlife. And this is a very tender and heartfelt episode, so come along with this. I think you might find it really interesting. And you know, really, it's a subject that will ultimately impact all of us. I feel if we're not afraid to die, then we're not afraid to live. And maybe because I had a 50-50 chance of survival at birth, I've never felt that far away from the other world. And it's always been clear to me that God is real and that we are all loved beyond belief. Our discussion today will not be connected to a religious tradition or to any set of belief systems, but will pivot around the stories people have shared. These are their personal experiences, things that they've gone through. So it's not out of the Bible or out of a wisdom text somewhere. It's actually personal experiences about living and dying. So we're going to talk about NDEs and SDEs. Let me tell you what those are. So that's near-death experiences, NDEs, or shared death experiences, SDEs. And my guest today, William Peters, is a specialist in SDEs. So, you know, as we go through this conversation, you might start to understand over and over again from all of these stories, this research, all these experiences that actually we never die. The soul never dies. The body will change, but the soul lives forever. So yeah, William Peter's specialty is doing the research. I mean, some of us might just know that to be true, but he's done an extraordinary amount of research. And let me tell you a little bit more about him and his Shared Crossings project. He's written a brilliant new book called Halfway to Heaven: Inside the Shared Crossing Experience, which is being published by Simon Schuster. But more than anything, I think what has impacted me about William Peters and his graceful end-of-life experiences is, you know, it really comes from a personal place. So I want to tell you a story. It's a personal story, and I have to sort of take a breath for a second here, but it's about my father, and I really loved my father very much when he was alive, and I still love my father as an essence to this day. But 3 years ago, my father began his dying process, and I wanted to be fully present, fully conscious with his crossing, and he was an interesting man. He was really brilliant. He was open-minded, intelligent, but he wasn't sure about what was going to happen. He wasn't sure if he believed in God. And but I will say that he was very open to inquiry, which made our shared experience very, very, very interesting. So when he became quite ill and was laying in bed and he couldn't really move anymore, and it was clear that he was not going to heal, that was over, and that I could even sense in his field that he was starting to change. You know, he was actively dying, that he was changing who he was. He was no longer to be this physical person, but he was going to be an essence. So anyway, I contacted William Peters, and he really assisted me over a period of several months in an understanding the protocol of death and dying, and it was incredible support. I really, you know, suggest to anyone who is going through either your own death, because we're going to go through it ourselves, or someone that we love is dying, you know, that that we can have a team of support around us that can help us understand this mystery that can actually be quite ecstatic and beautiful. So anyway, Dad and I were able to have a lot of discussions. I saw his fear fade away into curiosity. I really heard him speak to the people who had come to collect him, and I understood. I started to understand because of William Peters and his protocols, what was happening. I stayed open to it. It wasn't hallucination. He was actually talking to people on the other side. So it touches me just to speak about it now because it's a big subject. It's a big subject. And I really believe that when we can be fully present with those we truly love, that's the greatest gift we can give to them. And I want listeners to know this thing. You know, if you've lost someone and you couldn't be with them personally, they can hear your prayers always. Wherever you are in the world, send focused love from your heart to your dear one, and it will be received wherever in this world or the other. Prayer works. And we will, in this episode, get to what we can do specifically now in the crisis that we're in. So, okay, if you want to check out William Peters, I'm going to take a short break, but you can go to his sharedcrossings.com and check it out. And after we come back from this short break, I'm going to introduce William Peters and find out more about his near-death experience, also his research into shared death experiences, and how this work has changed and continues to change his life. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hello, everyone. This is Tonya Don Rekla, Executive Director of Superpower Experts. And we want to thank each of you for making Superpower Up the number one podcast network for personal development and spiritual growth. Because people like you have the courage to say that mindfulness, healthy living, disrupting reality, the pursuit of consciousness, responsible entrepreneurship, and radical parenting matter. We now amass over 1 million downloads monthly in more than 90 countries. Our numbers keep growing because there are far more people willing to live divergently than mass media wants to acknowledge. For you, the change makers, the light bearers, the way showers, we say thank you. If you're ready to take the next step in your evolution, go now to superpowerexperts.com and take the superpower quiz. And as Nivali Rekla, our youngest podcaster, likes to remind us, remember, we all have superpowers and we can change the world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. This is Anne Kate Sullivan, host of Wisdom of the Ages. Today, we're speaking with brilliant guest William Peters. Hello, William.
Hey, Anne. Good to see you. I can't see you, but good to hear your voice.
Oh, good to hear yours, too. And I just want to thank you for the help you gave me those years ago with my dad. That was so beautiful.
Well, you're very welcome. It was a blessing and a pleasure to be with you. It was, as you know, very poignant, beautiful time, and it was, like I said, a blessing to be a part of your family then.
It was so good because I really felt, with actually my whole family, for my mom, my sisters, and everyone who was involved, that we were all able to shift out of fear and come together with an incredible amount of love. It was a really profound experience that still touches all of us. So I know that it's really important for you that if people have had extraordinary end of life experiences, that they contact you. So where would they find you and send you their info?
Yeah, thanks for that. We're doing research, have been for 8 years, collecting and assessing and analyzing these end of life experiences. And our specialty, as I'll talk about a little bit later, is the shared death experience, which is an experience where somebody dies and a caregiver or loved one expresses that they shared in the transition with their departing loved one, and in many cases express that they feel like they went into the initial stages of the afterlife with the dying loved one. And so that's an experience that, as you mentioned, the book that's coming out with Simon Schuster, that's going to focus on that body of research. But we're also very interested in a full continuum of end-of-life experiences, from pre-death premonitions to pre-death dreams and visions. There's an experience called terminal lucidity, which is very close to the moment at which someone dies, even if they're very tired or unconscious, we call that unresponsive and an end of life, all of a sudden, sometimes the person just perks up and it gives the loved ones a response of like, oh, maybe he or she's coming back. When in fact, it's just this, what we call terminal lucidity, this moment of lucidity, of vitality, eyes open, memory returns, cognition is back online. And it's really a harbinger for death. And it's understood within the medical sciences, but they don't really understand it, so they don't give it a lot of attention. But we are studying this experience deeply. So if somebody has those experiences on the front side before death, we'd love to hear about those. And then on the backside of death, we're very interested in any after-death communication that happens, you know, within 6 months to a year after the death of their loved one. Typically, that's what we focus on. And we have a category called direct post-death communication. It's fascinating when someone will say that usually in the first few weeks after their loved one is gone, they use these words. It was like he or she was in my mind. It's like I had questions and he or she was answering them. So that's direct post-death communication. And then post-death dreams and visions. These are very common, I should say. About 50% of people will report after the death of a loved one that they will have a vision or a dream about their loved one. And that is something in our culture that is not really well advertised, if you will. But we collect these as well. And we look for synchronicities too. People will say, you know, clocks stop at our anniversary or birth dates, or every time we gather as a family, the electricity in the house goes out, lights flicker, or strangely, the person's favorite music comes on the stereo system and no one even turned it on. These are experiences that we see in the literature that we collect. And so if your listeners have those experiences, please contact us at info@sharedcrossing.com.
That's so beautiful. I remember that moment of lucidity with Dad when he started reciting poetry. It was this lovely last minute. And then I think there's a part I didn't tell you about. It was I was actually the minister for his funeral. And I did a little prayer before the funeral and said, Dad, I really want a sign that you're okay. And I didn't really hear anything, but he had been cremated. So I took his urn up to this mountain where he wanted his ashes spread. And when I got to the spot that he had asked me, it was actually a little medicine wheel, and that's where he wanted to be. There was literally a sign that had blown into the medicine wheel. And it read in Oum, which we both read, Old Irish, it read rebirth. So that was really pretty profound.
Yeah, and you took that as a synchronistic event, right?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah, a message from your father. And, we as researchers really have to, and we do this by nature, and I should say this, I'm an experiencer, which you'll learn about in a moment, I'm sure, in this interview, but I hired a real top researcher, Dr. Michael Kinsella, in religious studies, a PhD in religious studies and cognitive sciences. And he, when he came on board a number of years ago, he was very, cautious about these experiences. He said, I think these people this is kind of wish fulfillment. And they want to interpret, the cloud formations or the experience you gave, or, we live in Santa Barbara on the beach, and, people tell us all the time, I was just asking for a sign, and I walk on this beach every day, and all of a sudden the dolphins were jumping in ways that I've never seen before. There was whales spouting, and so, like, really, for a long time, we took these as like, okay, we'll take them lightly. But then the amount of data we collected was just spellbounding. It just couldn't – either everyone we're interviewing is a little bit off or a lot off, or these experiences just happened. Mm-hmm. And I know, since I'm a psychotherapist and I really do assess people to make sure that they're, mentally stable and balanced. If you ever get a chance to see our some of the videos of our research candidates, you'll see they are extraordinarily balanced in mind very healthy people. And most of them almost sheepishly say to us, you know, I had this experience, this synchronistic event, and I think it was something, but I can't share it with anybody because people think I'm crazy. Well, the amount of people that are walking around in our culture who've had these experiences that are afraid to share them because of what others might think of them, I think is significantly higher than anyone would ever know at this point. But hopefully our research and that of others will begin to open us more to the reality that it appears that there's either these, our deceased loved ones, or some benevolent force is inviting us to maintain communication and continue this bond with our departed. There's a saying that is very moving to me, and when I'm doing my trainings with people, I always say, you know, human death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the invitation for us, is to realize that human death is a transition from, it appears to be a transition from one state of being to another state of being. And we can get skilled at maintaining that relationship. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it has occurred to me, or I've noticed over the years, that a lot of, now these are difficult when children die, when your children die before you. And the only people that I've seen do well with that are the ones that have continued to create this relationship with their son or daughter on the other side. Also marriage partners, you know, if they can stay open to the love that's still there and understand that you're going to meet up again. Somehow these people, I don't know, what have you found with that? Has it helped people?
Oh, I think there's a major movement in grief and bereavement therapy, if you will, or counseling. Mm-hmm. And it's a movement called continuing bonds. You know, mm-hmm. most of us are probably aware that if you go and get help, or even just talking to our, you know, your loved ones after the death of someone significant in our lives, kind of the common shared cultural mantra is, you know, you need to let them go. Mm-hmm. You need to let them go and move on. Right. Well, this is not so easy for people, especially the elderly. And especially, as you said, if you lost a child, mm-hmm. that is just, you know, it is so hard for parents to move on from that, and siblings as well. So, but this kind of, I say it's new, it's been around since the 90s, but it's really growing in popularity because of its clinical efficacy and its usefulness. And it's, I think I want to say this, I think because people are now able to have these relationships with their departed children. And there's a movement, I'll talk about it. There's a group that's grown in the last few years. It's called Helping Parents Heal. Mm. And they honor this continuation of relationship beyond human death. And it is extremely meaningful. And when you have the permission to have an ongoing relationship, it opens one's up to be receptive to any type of communication that may be initiated by your departed loved one. So we have a lot of, in our study, we have a number of mothers, particularly some fathers as well, that will talk about their direct post-death communication with their departed child, and visions and dreams. And it really can become a continued relationship. It's a relationship. And some people will say even that all I have to do is think of that person and I feel them come to me. I know that feeling. I know that hug. I know that smell. So this is a whole field of grief and bereavement therapy that is going to continue to develop, and it's gaining acceptance as well.
That's incredible. Now, was it Raymond Moody, I guess, that opened up the near-death experience? I listened to Dan and Brinkley recently. I think you were involved with him at one point. But near-death experience, I think, when was it, the 80s when he started going into this and opening it up? Because before that, you would have been probably considered schizophrenic or mentally unbalanced or something if you had these discussions. And suddenly, you know, here's a doctor who's asking people who have had these experiences to come forward. And now you are doing like this next level of research with the SDEs. And I mean, what a great, great gift to humanity. But before you answer that question, why don't we go into your near-death experience, what happened, and why that changed your life, your first one?
Thanks. Yeah, so I had my first near-death experience in 1979. I was 17 years old, and I was just skiing at Squaw Valley, which is in Lake Tahoe, and just kind of tie into your reference to Dr. Raymond Moody. His book came out in 1975, Life After Life, and really was a groundbreaking book and a watershed moment that spawned the growing dialogue, interest, and eventual expansion of knowledge about and study about the near-death experience. So 4 years after that, I knew nothing about the near-death experience when I had my own at 17 years old. But it was a classical NDE. I crossed my skis up. I was launched into the air. I was at high speed. And then I hit the ground, and my ski bindings did not release. And I broke my back and my lumbars. And I heard the crunch, and I was immediately catapulted out of my body. And the next thing I knew was I was sailing away from my body, from the ski area. I could see Lake Tahoe. I could see the San Francisco Bay Area, Colorado Rockies, continental U.S., North America, I should say. And then all of a sudden, I was just, I mean, caught in absolute awe, bliss, and beauty of planet Earth and the solar system that was emerging around me. Soon, planet Earth was distant. I couldn't even recognize it. But I was having a life review the entire time. And I realized something in that life review that, you know, I needed to be more compassionate and I needed to be kinder, and that every action, thought even I'd ever experienced within me was recorded in some way. I saw it, and I saw the karma of it, karma being cause and effect. I saw how my little interactions rippled and impacted others. And then I was in this, you know, the classical tunnel. It was all very comfortable, but then I saw this light out into the distance, a beautiful light that caught my attention, and I realized I'm dying. And at that moment, I said, oh my gosh, I've been here before, and I don't want to die. And I got panicked. I was soon in that light, literally in the light. It felt velvety warm and blissful and loving, but majestic and powerful and all-knowing. And I pled with this light. I grew up Catholic, so I said, God, you have to let me go back. I haven't done my work. I'm not done yet. And I felt myself being kind of pushed back. And I started spinning the other way, if you will, as I returned. And as I was leaving the light, I heard, or I had a knowing sense of, make something of your life. And that was it. And then I found myself back in my body. But I did not speak of that experience for probably 10 years. And then I happened to see something channel surfing one night on someone sharing their near-death experience. And my body just lit up and said, I've had one of these. That's a something. I didn't know it was a something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was my first NDE.
Wow. You know, it really, I had a question when I was listening to it. When you were in the tunnel of light and you met this being of light, did you feel that you were one with the being, or did you still feel that you were a separate self?
You know, I felt like I was separate from that. It was kind of a separate and yet part of. In other words, I knew this was closer to my true home. Like, this is where I would return to at some point. This was where I came from. It was very clear to me that the experience as a human being was a temporary experience. It was something that I signed up for. and I needed to complete it, and I had a purpose with it.
It's how powerful that our thoughts, our words, and our deeds have such an impact, not only on our own lives, but on everyone around us. And who knows how far that ripple effect goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the law of the universe, cause and effect, one of the laws of the universe, was very clear to me. And, you know, I will say, I struggled with that. I continue to struggle with the challenges of being in a human body with all the, and being part of the human race, and, you know, all the challenges with a personality and ego and feelings. And, you know, I really appreciated, come to appreciate and practice in the, you know, kind of the more Buddhist, definitely Buddhist practice that really looks at the role of self and ego and all the emotions and feelings that drive us. It is a very difficult realm to be in. And yet at the same time, how we relate to ourselves and others and the way we relate to our planet is quintessential. And so this is a hard realm. I mean, because I have committed myself to waking up in a certain way and, you know, teaching what I've learned. And I bow in humility, humbly, to how hard it is to be a human being. It just is. You know, there's so many pushes and so many countervailing forces that we live within. And so, you know, I think it helps to see it that way. We're not supposed to be able to handle this. I think it's an illusion if we do. You know, I know there are a number of great teachers, wise beings, elevated, perhaps enlightened, if that's a term that works for people. And yet I've been blessed to meet and be with a number of these people, and I don't know any that don't struggle with this. I think the first step in waking up consciously is realizing just how difficult it is here. The Buddhists say this life is painful. There is pain in this life.
Yeah, this I think Buddha said life is pain and suffering except for the enlightened.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess that would be an interesting, I don't know if you're studying this also, but I know there's the Tibetan rainbow body. And so there are people that go through a conscious dying and the ego dissolves. And so they're actually merged with their soul and spirit self. And they're operating from that paradigm of presence. And then who knows what happens at that point at death? Maybe that's full conscious dying. That might take us into a completely different discussion, but I do think it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And, you know, I think the Tibetans and their the Tibetan Book of the Dead is perhaps one of the most clear and guided texts for how to die mindfully, consciously, lovingly. And what's so wonderful about that instructional guide, it's really a manual for death and dying, not just for the dying, but for the caregivers and loved ones, because they have a series of rituals and practices they do for at least 40 days after the person dies. So, and all this is extremely helpful, both for grief, for those who survive, and I can't say, because I don't go with the people who die, but I think the tradition has at least anecdotally, with, you know, a lot of, you know, they believe people come back and there's a 40-day journey through the bardos. But the tradition in and of itself, as you said, is very knowledgeable about these and very conscious about dying. And because of that, there's a healthy relationship with death and dying. They don't push it off. They don't deny it. They're knowledgeable about this process of dying and going into these bardos, which is, you know, different dimensions, which I think we would loosely call an afterlife.
Well, William, right now we're in this pandemic, and people are having all kinds of experiences and are frightened. I run into a lot of people that seem very frightened. And it seems that one of the ways that we can deal with this time that we're in right now is to overcome this fear of death. you know, to understand that life is eternal and that we needn't, we might be going through a paradigm shift, but we have no need to be frightened of it. So what are you seeing now with this?
So as you can imagine, it's a shared crossing project, and I'm a psychotherapist working in end of life and bereavement. We get lots of inquiries about this from people who are really quite understandably anxious and afraid, especially if they have a loved one who is dying alone, as is the situation with the COVID at this time. And what I share with people is that everything we know in near-death studies, even afterlife studies, is that our dying are met by either deceased known relatives, predeceased known relatives or loved ones, or other benevolent beings. They greet them at this moment of human death, and they help them transition into what comes next. And our research, which I can share briefly here, I mean, we have well over 200 cases of what we call shared death experiences. And that's where loved ones, as I said earlier, loved ones or caregivers seem to participate in this crossing over, if you will. And they share with us that this experience tells them that their loved ones are cared for, they're greeted. There's often a greeting party, if you can imagine, with many friends and relatives who the experiencer, the surviving loved one, recognizes as friends or relatives of the person dying and transitioning. This gives the caregivers a great deal of comfort and hope, and also a sense that where this person is, their departed loved one is going, is actually quite a benevolent realm. They feel that I know my loved one is safe, well cared for, and happy. And they also say, I know I'll see him or her again, and that I'm going there too. There's a vast opening in knowledge and wisdom. They say that realm that they experienced, albeit temporarily, is more real than our earthly existence. It's vaster. It's the ultimate reality. We live in this human life within that grander substrate of the universe. And so what I say to, to answer your question directly, I say to these people that our focus should be to really care for ourselves and our dying loved ones, and know that everything we have learned suggests that they will be greeted and assisted with this transition.
Oh, is there an issue because people can't be with their loved ones when they're dying?
Well, I mean, obviously we want to be with our loved ones when they're dying. That's ideal. But it's an interesting known fact in end-of-life care that about 1 in 3 people will die with no one around. And what's so interesting about this is we have many, many, I mean, the data is out here on this. Someone is dying, caregivers and loved ones want to be around them, typically. And oftentimes, they'll be surrounded by loved ones rotating in to be with the dying. And just at some fluke moment, if you will, where somebody goes to get a bite to eat or goes to the bathroom and they're alone momentarily, that's the moment in which the person dies. Mm. People say, well, I hear this all the time. I mean, I was with her the whole time. And then the one moment I stepped out to talk to the nurse about something, I came back and she was gone. My mother was gone. She had died. And I think there's something about, for some people, it's hard when their loved ones are with them. We serve as a type of glue or not so much holding them here, but certainly perhaps a little bit of stickiness on this side. Mm-hmm. And so when we give them space, they die more easily. I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying people need to know that and certainly not feel guilty or like you did something wrong if someone died when you walked out of the room. Like I said, we see it a lot. But I really encourage people in this time to do, to think, if you're not able to be with your loved one, and this goes for people who are not, who, you know, my father right now is in memory care, and no one in our family has been able to see him for 3.5 months now due to lockdown. He's on hospice. My mother was able to see him once only, and then the lockdown got more severe. So no one's seen him. But, you know, I encourage people to do these practices where you see their higher self. You see their soul, whatever you imagine goes from this life to the beyond. And if you don't have a sense for that, that's fine too. Just see them. And you know, prayer is a wonderful thing if that language works for people. Or just talk to their soul self and lovingly express your concern, your care for them, wish them well. If you have any unfinished business, forgive them. Tell them that you hope that they forgive you, and really work to clear any unfinished business. But, you know, people who do this practice can feel a sense of connection with them, a bond. And I suggest that to people.
It's really beautiful. Do you have a practice that you could share with us that might help us today?
Well, yeah, you know, one practice I suggest is that, you know, if you can do this any time of day, but I think this is really good right before you go to bed, because as we're going to bed, we go into kind of it's called a hypnagogic state. It's kind of like we're about ready to go into deep sleep, and we go into a dream state, and there's a fair amount of, how to say this, you know, our mind, our consciousness can move about, go on a tether from our physical body. And so, you know, you take a moment, take some breaths. If you have a meditation practice, even prayer practice, however, settle into yourself. Let go of the day. Let go of the day. If you do a breath meditation, of course, that helps. And think about the person, if you know somebody who is dying, or even in, like I say, in an assisted living, or just apart from you, if they're elderly and frail and sick and you have concern about them, place them in your mind's eye. And then review their life a bit. Go over their life and really your relationship with them. So really, when I say review their life, it's more focused on your relationship with them. And if a specific memory that evokes profound feelings of gratitude or joy for this person emerge, really sit with that. Allow yourself to take in those feelings of joy and appreciation, and let those feelings wash over you. And then, and really thank them for it. And just feel if you can have, some people report, and I do this frequently, so a kind of a bond with that person. There's a shared, you know, you may not feel something coming back, but many do, but you're really reaching out and connecting. And then you might want to remind them something like this: if for some reason this is your time to die, you know, I want to thank you for having shared this beautiful life with me. And should you, you know, die tonight and review your life, if you do have a review of your life, which, by the way, we know people have a review of their life. This is what we know from our research. When this memory of us together emerges, please call upon me and let me know that you're safe, well cared for, and happy. And so this is just a way to connect with your loved one, and then, you know, and really invite them to, and it's a gentle type of invitation to remind them that they, if they do die, to reach out to you in some way, let you know, give you a sign. I mean, I love that experience that you shared earlier with your father. Hey, Dad, send me a sign. This is well known in the literature. Going as far back as 1865, the London Society for Psychical Research studied death compacts. Death contracts is what they, you know, really are. And this is one of those, a gentle invitation to invite our departed loved one to reach out to us. So yeah, that's an exercise that I think gives people a great deal of solace if you're in that state.
I think it's that was so beautiful and really touched my heart. So thank you for sharing that. I think it's so important for people to understand. You're a psychotherapist, and you know, this type of work is becoming more and more acceptable. So we can, you know, we can go through the church this way, but we can also have our direct knowing and our direct experience, and it can be validated by your team, really. You know, if someone might get in touch with you, and they might even be able to open the experience even more, I would think.
Well, yeah, absolutely. One of the unforeseen, benefits of our research is that when experiencers contact us, and we read their report or their account, their story, if you will, and then we invite them into an interview if we feel like this is something that we want to learn more about, then we have an interview, and what we hear, because our questions, of course, are very engaging. They're deep. We're trying to understand, so they're nuanced. They bring people into a deeper relationship and understanding with their experience. And afterwards, they'll say to us, "This was just wonderful. It's like I feel like I relived this experience. I was able to access parts of this I didn't even know were there." And they're quite grateful for the affirmation that the interview gives, and the processing of their experience, and the integration of it into their life and understanding of human life and human death. And then we encourage them to share these experiences with others, because that really helps integrate it too. Not just anybody, but someone who you think might be open to hearing this and really be grateful for your sharing of it.
I know the interview that I did with you, it helped me, because a lot of people around me were grieving pretty hard. And of course, that's one aspect of what's going on. But there were so many different layers to it that when I did the interview, I was able to also understand the ecstatic part and the joyous part and the continued love connection and much more about essence. And so I highly recommend people engage. It can be difficult, you know, because you do have to open your mind up to the fact that yes, there is a mystery. And I think what helps me is to understand that this mystery, what God, whatever we want to call God, really loves us, cares for us, and will look after us forever. So that's that's part of this experience. Would you say that there's some truth to that?
Well, people express it in different ways, depending on their own spiritual religious tradition. What we do find repeatedly, and this is one of the major findings, is that no matter what spiritual religious tradition you practice in prior to these experiences, in particular the share-death experience, that's what most of our research is on right now, is that they feel like this experience changes everything. It's deeper than any other religious experience, spiritual experience that they've had. And it really turns them into a way, they'll say, "I feel that I'm more spiritual now than I've ever been. And while I may maintain my religious practices or my religion, I feel like this experience has recast everything." And they talk about a oneness with everything. They feel like this experience opened them to this sense of a greater loving source, a power, something that was kind and loving and all-knowing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is our definition of God in the West, of course, and Atman in the East, depending on, you know. So these experiences are highly transformational, and you know, as you know, the spiritual nature of them invites us, if not demands us, to rework and redefine, based on this experience, how we see ourselves, our world, this incarnation. And as you mentioned, there is definitely a sense for a loving, benevolent power that is mediating our human experience.
That's so beautiful. Now, if I'm correct, you had a second near-death experience.
I did. When was 1992? I had contracted a rare blood disease, And it's because I spent a lot of time in Central and South America. And so I came back. Actually, I should say it was idiopathic thrombocytopenia, which is, and you know, idiopathic means unknown cause. Mm-hmm. So they didn't really know what was causing it, but the fact that I'd been in highly infectious regions in Peru and Guatemala suggests I picked up something there. And I also was taking a medication, an anti-inflammatory. So for whatever reason, my platelets crashed. I was kind of in a type of hemophiliac tradition condition, and I was in the 10th floor of Kaiser Hospital in Oakland in the ICU, and I was floating above my bed. I just realized I kind of came to an awareness that I am on the ceiling of this ICU. I was then able to move about the room and see nurses talking in the wee hours of the morning. I moved down the hallway, saw janitors doing their work. It was just, and I was very comfortable, very much at peace. That experience really confirmed, if you will, and brought home that any sense of a me, of a William, was not dependent on my physical body, because I was moving around fully outside of that body. And it was quite encouraging. I was not in any pain, although my body was under a great deal of distress. So yeah, that was my second near-death experience.
It's really interesting that you still had, now would that be a persona? You still had a personality, even though you weren't in your body.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know how much of my personality was really there. It felt like it was just consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, mindfulness, kind of an a witnessing aspect, observing aspect of myself. I didn't really, I mean, I knew that, well, this is another part of the experience. A doctor came in, a hematologist, a specialist from UC San Francisco's medical center. And he came in, it must have been 3 or 4 in the morning. And he then tapped on my body to wake me up. And I was above my body looking at that. And then I was observing, and then all of a sudden he said, Mr. Peters. And then I looked at them and I didn't really catch what was going on. But then I realized, oh, wow, that's me. Or kind of funny. That's the way I said, but I'm up here too. That's really interesting. And then I realized I had a choice. I could go back into that body or I could stay where I was. And that was profound. And then he was trying to get my attention. I said, and I was remember thinking, should I go back into my body? Should I answer him? What if I did answer him? And I said, well, I think I'll just answer his question from up here. And the minute I said yes, because he was asking Mr. Peters, are you awake? May I talk to you? And I said, yes. And the minute I did that, I could feel the energy fill back into my physical body, almost like sand in an hourglass, filling back in. And that felt like energy. I was getting more energized, more revitalized, which was an experience I remember from my first NDE on the ski slopes. When I finally got back to my body, I could feel the energy move across my body and fill in my first in the middle of my body and then move out to my extremities. And the same thing happened here. It was like my consciousness was coming back into that body and like booting it up again. So I can't remember what question I was answering there, but
it was just about your second near-death experience. But how interesting that somehow we are this body, we are our emotions, we are our mind, we are our persona, we have an ego, which I don't think is a mistake, and yet we're not that. You know, that there is this soul, if we want to call it, or there is a spark of life that's in each of us, and it's that spark, somehow that piece of, that spark of consciousness that never dies. Is that what you're finding?
I think, yeah, I mean, well, once again, as from my own experience, I have felt that and sensed that. And that's the way I would authentically make sense of this, is that some aspect of my being, what in, right now as a human, survives human death and seems to move on, and goes into, you know, I have experience being in a few different dimensions. In the second near-death experience in the ICU, I stayed very close to my body. In the first one, I was launched into the cosmos and went to the light, you know, the grand loving light. And then our research suggests the same thing. We ask, how do you interpret this experience to our over 200, you know, candidates? And they're adamant. The term they use is, this is not belief. They say, I know my loved one is alive and well in the afterlife. I know I will be with him or her again. I know I will survive human death. And I have no fear of death. That's the other thing. Mm-hmm. These people, without question, say that if they had any fear of death, it is ameliorated.
Right. So somehow we have a life purpose and mission. We're sent here on a specific assignment. Is that evolution and consciousness, or is it different for everybody?
Well, that's very interesting, because that's another one of, we call these the after effects, which all seem to be beneficial. From the share death experience, there's transformation. We see transformation of self beliefs, all that. And one of them is an understanding, an awakening to what this human life is about generally, and even in most cases specifically, what their human life is about. So it's a sense that they're here in this human incarnation for a specific purpose, and they often get about doing that. And so, yes, I think your description of this is, you know, an understanding that we go on, we're here now for specific purposes and reasons, and our work as human beings is really to figure out what that is, first of all, and then to live it. And I do think there's also times when we've achieved that I think in some ways, I think people are kind of done with their life. I can't make a judgment about this, but I do think a lot of people don't know why they're here, and that's quite distressing. And I think for a lot of people, the shared death experience, as is the near death experience, is a real waking up point. For me, I know it served that way. And both of my near-death experiences, and increasingly when I have these shared death experiences with people, I'm reminded almost in a way humiliating that, oh my God, I know this. I have to do better with this. I have to focus on this. I should say, it's not like these are not shameful experiences. I think it's healthy shame. As a psychotherapist, I'm able to distinguish between what is like toxic shame and what is healthy shame. There's, you know, for me, I feel grateful for the opportunities to be reminded of what I'm here for, what my values are, and to live them, and to realize this is an opportunity. I have to live in agreement with these deeper truths that in some ways I'm not able to put words on, but I feel them in my body.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it does seem that discovering the life purpose and mission that we each have is very, very important. And our culture can run contrary to that, since we tend to live in a very materialistic culture. So maybe this is part of the paradigm shift, is realizing actually the veil's quite thin as we enter this new time.
Yeah, I mean, I think people do tend to come back with a more altruistic way of seeing the world, and a need to, you know, like, be kinder, compassionate, and also to be of service. Mm-hmm. That's just a real big piece.
Yeah,
that comes. You know, I wanna not miss the opportunity to define the difference between the near-death experience and the share-death experience, because the share-death experience, I've defined it, but I want to give one example that was my first example of this when I was working at Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. You know, I was just at the bedside of a person, Ron, who was dying, and reading him a book. And in fact, it was a book that he loved to hear. And that was a Jack London story about Call of the Wild, the Arididae. Mm-hmm. And it was an adventure story. And this gentleman had been a merchant marine in his life, so he loved adventuring. So I was reading this story to him one afternoon. I can still see myself sitting in the sunny Laguna Honda hospice ward in San Francisco. And all of a sudden, I just popped out of my body. And there I was. The first thing I noticed was I was out of my body. I was looking down at my body in a chair and next to Ron's body, and Ron was prone in his hospital bed. And then I looked to my right, and there was Ron's face, big and expressive and joyful. And he looked at me as if to say, check this out. Check this out. It was as like he invited me there to see this. And this was a spectacular experience for me. It was my first real bona fide shared death experience that was so clear. We would call this in our research a co-experienced out-of-body experience. Co-OBE. And, you know, I'd been in this space before in the ICU at Kaiser during my near-death experience, so I was very comfortable being there. But sharing it with Ron and seeing how at peace he was and playful and joyful gave me so much solace about, you know, dying. I mean, I'd already had it for me personally, but then this was my real introduction to, like, oh my gosh, these experiences happen and they're available to us. And just like my NDE, I can share this experience. Our loved ones can share this with their dying. And, you know, much later in my life, it was 2009 when I heard Raymond Moody talk about his initial research of shared death experiences, where he had a number of stories that were told to him, mostly letters written to him. And so he put up a little he laid out the features of the shared death experience. But when I mentioned this to Raymond, that I had these and was very interested in developing kind of a deeper understanding for these, provide to people in our culture who would be facing death and to facilitate the SDEs. He was very supportive, and we've maintained our relationship through the years. And that's what the Share Crossing Project is dedicated to, and the Share Crossing Research Initiative is studying these experiences. And so, you know, another one that's really interesting, I'll just give one example that has to do with a woman who was at the death of her husband. And it's quite short, so it's easy to say, but he dies and she reports kind of ascending with him. Ascension is a big part of this experience. So she's going up with him. They're together in the afterlife, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they're trading places. He's leading and she's leading, very joyful. And all of a sudden, she sees her mother-in-law, his mother. Mm-hmm. And he looks at his mother, and then he looks back at his wife and says to his wife, I love you. I will always love you. But I think it's my time to go. And she looks at him and she says, I love you too. And as much as it's going to pain me to let you go, I see that it's your time to go and I will let you go. And then she comes back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's just such a beautiful account. We have so many similar like this, where you see the guide, the mother that seems to greet the son, let the wife know, I've got it. I'll take it from here. We call that the handoff.
Oh, wow.
The handoff. Such a beautiful interaction. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to give your listeners a sense of the SDE, and they can go to our website to learn a bit more about it. But mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, we're running out of time, and I have so many more questions for you, but thank you so much. And I hope all the listeners really come away today with a sense of peace, you know, that we're really, everyone's okay, that we have nothing to fear, that we're all loved and that we're all one. So
that's the message. And you just said it so succinctly.
Well, thank you so much. And where can people go to find you again? Can you offer your website one more time?
Yeah, sharedcrossing.com. And if you want to share, submit a story, an end-of-life account, we very much appreciate that. For us to do our research, it's people who are willing to share their stories with us that really helps our research go. And you can find that on our contact page. If you go to our contact page on the website, there'll be instructions for how to submit your story to us. And then we usually get it, and we review it. Our team will review it, and we'll get back to you. So, if you have other specific questions for me or the team here, info@sharedcrossing.com.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for all the good work that you do in the world. So many, I'm sure, on this side and the other side, people appreciate you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you so much for the work you're doing, just bringing your love and kindness and wisdom through this podcast and all the work you've done and the wonderful books you've written. People don't know about those. Those are really inspiring and extraordinarily well written. So, I thank you for your work as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So you've been listening to Anne Kate Sullivan, host of Wisdom of the Ages, and you can find my books if you want to on annekatesullivan.com or infinitelightpublishing.com. It's always good to spread that sparkle, a little bit of light. So until we meet again, may wisdom reveal its secrets to you one message at a time.
Are you ready to discover your superpowers? Go now to superpowerexperts.com and take the superpower quiz today.